This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Rory Stewart, who is a member of the British Parliament from Penrith and the Border. He's the author of numerous books, including the New York Times bestseller, The Places in Between, and also the author of The Prince of the Marshes. His most recent publication with Gerald Knaus is Can Intervention Work? Rory, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Hong Kong, and a lot of my childhood was spent in Malaysia.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world?
My father is much older than me, so he's 50 years older than me. He was 50 when I was born. And he is a man who has been civil servant, but is also a sort of natural rebel. So his basic character is defined by feeling that all his colleagues in the whole civil service are not getting on with things. He's a very sort of active, vigorous person. Still is. I mean, he's just about to turn 91, and he's still charging up and down, digging things up, and cutting down trees and causing trouble for people. So I think that that's what I took from him. I mean, his central motto in life is get on with it.
And your mother?
My mother was an academic, and she, I think, is an enormously important influence on my life, but in a strange way, I don't see her quite in the way that I see my father. When I think about my father, I think about this very eccentric, colorful figure in tartan trousers charging around causing trouble. My mother, who's actually a very active, vigorous person, I somehow see as a sort of more natural, quieter part of my life. I don't see her as quite as extreme a caricature as I see my father.
And your father was stationed abroad, so you were seeing the world as a young person already.
That's right. So he was a man who served in the Second World War, and then was sent to Malaya straight after that. So he served all over Asia. He served Philippines, Shanghai, Beijing, Burma, Hong Kong, Vietnam. And I think a lot of my whole way of looking at the world was created by the fact that we're from a Scottish family, but a Scottish family that's really been connected with the army, with the foreign service, and therefore been on the move.
And was there discussion of world events around the dinner table? Or was it all through osmosis in your daily life?
A lot of it was osmosis. My father does talk a lot, but he would tend when I was a child to be lecturing me on Napoleon or proofs of the existence of God when I was six. Or he would pick up books and then get excited about particular themes. They tended not to be world events. They tended to be a particular historical or philosophical issue he was interested in.
And where were you educated before you went to college?
So I was initially sent to school in London when I was four. And then when I was six, I went to school in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur. And then when I was eight and a half, I was sent back to boarding school in England. My parents continued to live in Malaysia and Hong Kong. And I was educated at a school in Oxford, and then I went to Eton. And then I left that and went into the army and then on to university.
And what subjects attracted you in your higher education?
I initially loved history and then decided to change to study philosophy. I remember being stuck looking at some document on how many people in rural Westphalia went to church in the 1490s and suddenly feeling I really don't care.
So, as I understand it, you were in the military before you went to Oxford. Talk a little about that. What unit were you in, and so on?
I was in the Black Watch, which is a very traditional Highland Scottish regiment, which had been my father's regiment and my grandfather's regiment, and indeed my great grandfather's regiment. And it was a very strange time. This was the early 1990s, so Cold War had ended, nothing else had really begun. Nobody in my regiment had actually been to war since the Korean War for 40 years. Two generations had gone through. And it was almost unimaginable for me then that we would suddenly find ourselves, as indeed the regiment did, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, in Iraq, in Afghanistan. It felt like a strange unit stuck in the middle of Britain preparing for some war against the Soviet Union, which clearly was never going to happen.
And so talk a little about, so this is really your first encounter with an intervention abroad, and so what were you seeing and thinking as this regiment was stationed there?
I suppose it was a strange time. I mean, I joined the army when I was 18 as a young infantry officer, and I felt at the time that it wasn't quite what I expected. I thought that being in the army was going to be full of incredible excitement and charging around. And actually, we were based in a barracks in England, doing a lot of drill and training without much money. And a certain amount of my time was spent dealing with court cases. My soldiers would get into trouble in town, and I'd go in to represent them in court. A lot of my time seemed to be spent doing strange pieces of paperwork and worrying about the fact there were no blank rounds for anybody to fire. There was a sort of slight element, I think, of somewhere between Catch-22 and MASH about my whole introduction to the thing.
So, but you were, this probably was your first encounter with a bureaucracy and the structure of a bureaucracy.
Yeah. And indeed, I've gone on into many bureaucracies. I mean, I, in different ways, my most recent job was at Harvard University, which was another sort of strange bureaucracy, where I remember turning up for my first day and taught my class, and I got back, and then I said to everybody, well, what am I supposed to do now? And I just felt this sort of great silence all the way around me, and the sense that whatever it was that I was supposed to be doing, I couldn't quite grasp it. I couldn't quite grasp the function of the institution. I feel the same in Parliament. I mean, I feel that I keep going into these great ancient institutions, the British Army, Harvard University, the British Parliament, and I have a sense that they were designed for quite a different purpose for what they're now doing, and that we have all these rituals and buildings and things that we do, but exactly why we're doing them or what the benefit is to anybody is sometimes quite difficult to find.
And so this is your father's DNA roaring within you in response to the settings you're finding yourself.
Yes, I'm afraid so. I'm afraid my father sort of encourages this sense of impatience.
Yeah. And, so after the military, you went into the diplomatic service.
That's right.
And Another bureaucracy.
And I was posted to Indonesia initially, where I learned Indonesian. I spent 2.5 years trying to understand the end of Suharto's Indonesia. That was another big introduction to me because I arrived in 1997 when the Indonesian economy was booming. And everybody said, this economy is unstoppable. I remember in August 97, a big seminar in Jakarta, and they said, this economy is like an aircraft carrier. It's growing 8% this year. You know, maybe next year it might drop down to 7%, but basically it's unstoppable. The currency is at 2,000 to the dollar. And within 2 months, everything had collapsed. The economy went into a 17% contraction. 98% of the companies on the stock exchange had gone bankrupt. The currency had gone from 2,000 to 17,000 to the dollar. And by May, we had riots in the streets, Suharto stepping down. And then by the time I finished, East Timor going independent, which was almost inconceivable 2 years earlier.
So in a way, this was an experience in which you suddenly saw that, well, the reality that you thought was there wasn't once the bubble collapsed.
Yes, I think I came out of it with an incredible sense of complexity, that we were trying to make confidence statements about the economy or confidence statements about Indonesian society, and I began to realize they were based on very, very little. They were grand confidence theories which could be produced in a seminar, but I really began to felt these things are inherently chaotic, unpredictable, uncertain. And although at the time I was very proud to be standing in the streets of Jakarta with students rebelling against Suharto, the students obviously rebelling, I was a British diplomat standing alongside them, I think I'd never fully thought through as a British diplomat what that was going to mean. You know, we're talking about human rights, we're going to talk about democracy, but what would that actually mean for those people over the next 10 or 15 years of their lives?
Now, once you were in the diplomatic corps, then you left and you took a leave and you set about to walk across a lot of Asia. And in fact, you walked how many miles? 6,000 miles on foot. Tell us about what your goal was and how that bee got in your bonnet, so to speak.
I think I felt that the most powerful way for me to learn about the world was to walk across it, because I felt that only by putting one foot in front of the other would I really be able to touch reality. I liked the idea that instead of my previous experience of the world, which was little snapshots, disconnected, jumping by plane or train from one city to another, I would have a sense of how the whole thing sat together. I'd move more slowly through it. I'd see rural areas. I'd spend time living in village houses. I'd get a sense of what the world really was like. And for me, that's what walking promised. It didn't quite deliver it. I mean, it turned out, of course, that you miss a lot walking. There are many things you don't understand by walking. But before I did it, I imagined that walking would somehow magically let me know what the world was really like.
And you did you have athletic prowess? Was this something that, as a Scotchman, you had done a lot of walking and so on? I mean, one has to start with the strength and the legs, I guess.
Well, it's a big Scottish tradition, yeah. Walking. Scots walk a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a funny man from my clan, from my Highland clan, called Walker Stewart, who walked across the whole of India and eventually walked all the way back to Britain in the 1700s. Highland Scots particularly were always very proud of walking. They didn't really ride horses. One of the big differences, in fact, when they went to battle against the Scots from the borders, is everyone on the borders was on a horse and everyone from the Highlands was on foot.
You somebody who is walking, in addition to the strength, you really, as your book on Afghanistan, we'll talk about that in a second, you're really observing. You're listening. Talk a little about that, because you in a way were really seeing things now in a way that in these other experiences when you're embedded in a bureaucracy, you weren't, from what you just said. Yeah,
that's right. I think as a government official, it's very, very difficult to really learn much about other people's lives. You interact with people in a very formal setting and very briefly and very business-focused. On the walk, I stayed in 500 different village houses, so every night I can sit on a mud floor and I'm there for hours. You know, I probably get there 4:30 in the afternoon.
Now, you're talking about all of Asia now? Or just,
talking Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Nepal. Yeah. So again and again in all these countries, the same pattern. I set off from a village house at about 8:30 in the morning, and by about 4:30, I've got to another village house, and almost always people would welcome me in, and I would sit down, and I would be there for the next 16 hours. During that time, I'm forcing myself, or I'm forced to, do nothing except listen to people talk about themselves. I become very attentive to the way they describe themselves, the way they interact with visitors. And it was the most precious gift, because probably in retrospect, I might have been a bit frightened of people before, a bit uneasy about what real people were like. It made me immensely optimistic, because in all those communities, I came away with a very, very strong sense of people's that they were good people. I mean, basically, almost everybody who put me up was, in some way or another, somebody who I was proud to encounter.
And you must have had a lot of empathy and sympathy as the more people you met, the more so that you came to really understand the structures that they were embedded in. And it sounds to me that you found that a more human experience than the bureaucracies you've already mentioned that you were in your previous roles.
Yes, and was very, very useful for me for then onwards in really talking to those bureaucracies, because a lot of the basis of all discussions, doesn't matter whether you're talking about Afghanistan or you're talking about domestic politics in the United States, involves making claims about people. You know, the American people think this, the Afghan people think this, this is what they're going to accept, this is what they won't accept, this is what they want. And yet most of the people having those conversations really don't have much to go on. I mean, they might do an opinion poll or something, but what's always lacking in the room is somebody to confidently say, no, this is actually the way that I think people might think about the situation, or this is how they might react, or this is how this might go down. And we're so bad at that, because what we do is we produce things which we think are a good idea. And we find it very difficult to accept somebody saying, okay, maybe it's a good idea, but nobody's going to want it. Natural instinct is, for example, I've just been doing a sewerage project in Afghanistan, in Kabul. I had this wonderful German engineer working with me, and he says, it's a very good idea, we're going to put in this sewerage system. And Afghans keep saying to me, it's never going to work. We don't want this thing. But of course, the reaction of the German engineer, understandably, is, what are you talking about? This is irrational. This is a good thing. We're going to get it going, right? And you end up spending a lot of time and often a lot of money doing things that don't work.
And why didn't they want the, you know?
Very difficult to understand. I mean, and this is one of the problems for foreigners, that you have to some extent, eventually just take it as read that they don't want it. They can explain in different details. You know, so our Afghan engineer would explain that one of the problems is the way in which people wash themselves in their courtyards and mud gets into the sewage system. Another problem is vendettas between families. People deliberately block up the neighbor's sewage pipe as a way of getting at their neighbor. I mean, but these are things that are very difficult to communicate. Solar panels on roofs. Again, a wonderful idea in Afghanistan, theoretically, because a little bit like California, there's a lot of sun. But for whatever reason, communities in Afghanistan are very reluctant to maintain these solar panels. And again, the engineer says, well, that's absurd. You know, all you've got to do is get on the roof and remove the sand and the dust from the solar panel every day, and your solar panel will work well. But at some point, having pushed and pushed and pushed, you just have to accept that for whatever reason, these people do not want to go on their roof every day and clean the dust off the solar panel, and therefore solar power is not the answer to this community.
Now let's focus on your walk across Afghanistan, which is chronicled in your book, The Places in Between. When did you undertake that journey, and what was the length of that journey? And you've talked a little already about the way you observed. So let's focus on that. But you did it after the overthrow of the Taliban.
Right. So I set off on this long walk across Asia, and I'd started out in Turkey. And I'd walked across Iran, but the Taliban wouldn't let me into Afghanistan. So I'd hopped, and I'd walked across Pakistan and India and Nepal, and I was just approaching the edge of Bangladesh. When 9/11 happened, the Taliban government fell, and I suddenly got this chance to go to Afghanistan, and I quickly realized the chance to walk from Herat to Kabul. So I set off to Herat in the west, and essentially what I was doing was trying to connect my walk across Iran with my walk across Pakistan. Afghanistan was that bit in between that I'd missed. And I walked across Afghanistan for, I suppose, sort of months and a half, really. It's all it took me to get from Herat to Kabul. But it was a very curious month and a half. It was a month and a half during which time I didn't wash. I obviously couldn't phone or talk to my family. I disappeared, basically, in Herat and reappeared in Kabul. That stage in Afghanistan, there's no electricity between Herat and Kabul. Televisions, no radios, no telephones. And no government, no police, no army, no civil service. I was reliant completely on the goodwill of individual villagers who could, had they wished, at any moment, murdered me, robbed me. And nobody would have found out, or presumably my parents eventually, after 2-3 months of not getting a phone call, would have thought, well, something must have happened.
Yeah. So this took a lot of courage. Just put that on the table. Do you sense that you had courage in doing this, or was it rather your commitment to the goal of doing what you were doing?
It's very difficult to really answer that question. I mean, one of the reasons I feel uncomfortable at it is I think this idea of courage is, it's a slightly maybe overrated virtue. I mean, I think there are quite a lot of young men who, like me, are happy to do things like walk across Afghanistan. And I was lucky. I'm lucky to make it out alive. But I never felt, most of the time, I didn't really feel particularly frightened. But at the same time, I don't think that's something that I should be immensely proud of. I just think that's my personality. I'm just not particularly, I'm maybe not very imaginative.
At one point in your book, I think you say you were looking at Afghanistan and being myself. And that's what you've just described. So in a way, by stripping away all of these accoutrements of modernity, then you actually could focus and do what you were doing, which I guess was interacting, observing, and writing.
Interacting, observing, and writing, and being treated by villagers not as anything other than an anonymous stranger. I mean, I became accustomed over that 500-day walk, because the Afghan walk actually was not very different in some ways to walking across Iran or Pakistan. I just became accustomed to people taking me in very simple terms. I mean, there was no sense of what my background was, really where I came from. Some of these communities, the women had never been more than 3 hours' walk from their village in their lives, so that the market town I'd walked from that morning was as distant to them as Paris. I mean, they. So if I said to them, I've walked here from Turkey, it didn't mean anything at all. It's completely meaningless. And if I said I came from Scotland, that was, equally meaningless. I like that because I think I'd always felt, in a funny way, I came from quite a privileged background in Britain, that maybe people were judging me on the basis of my clothes, my accent. I didn't feel that on the walk. On the walk, I felt people saw this slightly disheveled figure. And what did they know about him? They knew that he'd somehow walked to their village from somewhere.
And was going to go on to the next village. Yeah. So there's a funny kind of thing. So in their seeing you stripped in a way, I mean, you were dressed, but I mean, in terms of the accoutrements of modernity or being a diplomat or being a soldier, they saw you, but then you were empowered to really see them. And what you saw was the traditional social structures. I get a sense in reading your book of the extent to which there are many peoples in Afghanistan, and they are embedded in a region in a way. You talk about people going to work in Iran or somewhere and so on. So you saw a fluidity and a resilience in traditional structures that obviously, if you were flying overhead in a helicopter, you would never have seen.
That's right. And I like the fact that you've observed the fact that many of them had been to work in Iran or Pakistan and that they were embedded in a broader region. Because it's a paradox. On the one hand, these villages feel unbelievably isolated. They're 10 days' walk from the nearest road in the winter. And as I say, some of the women have barely been outside the edge of the village. On the other hand, they're surprisingly sort of aware of the outside world. People will have walked that 10 days easily and comfortably. People will have been to Tehran, some of them will have been to Mecca, people will have been to Delhi. And they will have understood their own country in a way we don't quite understand in our countries, because they will have walked 23 days to Quetta to get weapons to fight against the Soviet Union and carried guns and mules back on their back for 28 days to get back to their village. They will have used their landscape in a different way to us, to mount ambushes, to bury their relatives. They are aware of genealogies and histories in a way that we're not. And some of these people could recite their parents and great-grandparents going back 7 generations. I was fascinated by all of this. I mean, it along with all the things which are very sad about Afghanistan, and there are many, many of them, and I think it's much easier, of course, as a foreigner to romanticize the country than to actually be an Afghan trapped in it. There were so many aspects of that society which were genuinely seemed moving, fulfilling, intriguing, beautiful.
One of the interesting things that you lacked in this walk was power. And so they could see you just as an individual taking the walk, bringing a letter from somebody to introduce you, and then being given a letter on to the next one. And you bring out the extent to which they are used to outsiders coming in and exerting power. And part of their flexibility is to adapt to the new outside intervener.
Right, absolutely. Well, as you say, these people are have both faced extraordinary internal Afghan fights. The Afghan king in the 1880s essentially has enslaved the Hazara population of central Afghanistan. They've seen the Soviet Union come and go. They have folk tales about the British invasion of 1841. They have strong sense of American and British forces beginning to move around, of the Taliban having arrived and then left again. So, yes, they're perpetually dealing with these shifting things, but equally, it's remarkable how strong the village unit remains. And in some ways, you sense how irrelevant some of this has been. How, yes, it's true that this village has seen the king come, has seen the Soviet Union come, has seen the Taliban come, has seen. But it's still, in some sense, the village. And they've learned to speak different kinds of language, and they've learned to deal with different kinds of people, but it's still the village.
Subsequently, I believe it's subsequently that you're back on special assignment in Iraq, and you become the deputy governor of two provinces. That's after this war. So I'm curious. I want to bring this power element, because now you're suddenly presented with power. You're a representative of the British government in marsh areas, and in a way, you have the accoutrements of power now. But you're able to see things as they are, both because of your previous experiences and as you're interacting, you're observing, and so on. And you say at one point, the job of an administrator in your book on this experience on the ground in Iraq was not the job of a diplomat, a development worker, a soldier. It was the job of the 1920s Chicago ward politician. So the difference now is that you have some power, but you actually confront a reality where the social structure, the existing interactions prevail and make what we're trying to do, that, namely transform this into some sort of liberal democracy, highly unlikely.
Right. And, of course, I don't know much about what a Chicago ward politician really was like. But
it sounds right.
my sense of it is that what I was trying to say is that it was chaos, and you were improvising, and you were pretending to have more power than you actually did, and you were desperately forming alliances and trading off, and I had money. I was given $8 million a month in vacuum-sealed packets, which we were meant to be distributing to different people. You would have an idea, okay, we're going to build a big project here, we'll employ 3,500 people, and that will suddenly be disrupted because a bomb's gone off or people are demonstrating outside your building. You have a sense of this very turbulent, fluid, and violent society. And you, of course, are sitting there with some things which you can do. I mean, you are, of course, connected to American and British soldiers, and ultimately they can send in planes and bomb people. You have dollars and cash. But in another sense, you're completely powerless. Everybody knows you're going to go. You'll be there for a year at most, and then you'll vanish. Everybody senses you're not from there. You don't speak the language well. You don't understand the religion. You have no idea of anybody's background. Everybody's a stranger to you. They've all lived alongside each other for generations. They know exactly who's been an Iranian spy, who's been collaborating with Saddam, who's and the other. You've got absolutely no idea. You're perpetually sitting there suspiciously in meetings, trying to work out whether the person is sincere, whether they're trying to cheat you, whether they're... And you're also trying to work out what your own ideals are and what are you trying to actually do for people. Are you trying to clean up the police and get rid of torture? How can you do that if in Abu Ghraib your own side has suddenly been shown to be torturing people? You're trying to bring economic development, but what sort of model of economic development are you trying to bring? I mean, fine, it sounds, say it quickly, employment, infrastructure, but to what extent is this stuff going to remain when you leave? How does this economy really work? To what extent is your cash distorting it? It becomes a very, very odd thing. You feel that you're sort of on a waterbed, standing on a waterbed, which is kind of lurching around under you.
In both of these experiences, we have to bring out the other dimension of what you were as you found yourself and so on. You were a writer, basically. So you, in a typical day, you would keep a diary. Tell us a little about that. How much would you write at night once you had lived your day?
Well, on the walk, I was writing about 2.5 hours a day. I mean, I have piles of notebooks, cheap Iranian exercise books, filled full of drawings and notes. In Misan, I was, of course, taking notes all the way through meetings, not for a book, actually. I wasn't intending in Iraq to write a book. But maybe in the back of my mind, I thought a book could come out of it. But most of those notes are actually practical notes. They're recording what people are saying, explaining what action points we have and what we've agreed to go, where to go. I wonder whether being a writer helped me or didn't help me. And I certainly have a strong sense that I'm less good as a writer because I do all this politics stuff. I think really good writers need to step away from that and have nothing else to do.
We've touched on this briefly, but I don't want to get sense. So in a way, all of these different roles, soldier, diplomat, walker, explorer, official, you know, after an intervention, you were learning a lot from each experience, which informed the next experience and your overall view.
I hope so. I try to relate them to each other and keep these different things fresh and feeding into each other. But it is easy to come a little bit rigid in your mind. I mean, it's quite easy for these different experiences not to remain as vibrant and as lively as you'd like. It's quite easy to lapse back into cliches, habits of mind, where you begin to see your past in preset molds. So, yeah, it's an effort. It's an effort not to stop. It's an effort not to just sit back and say, okay, now this is my view on this thing. What I'd like, but I'm not as good at as I should be, is to keep looking back at these experiences and questioning myself again and again and again.
One of the themes that emerges in your writing would fit under, if I can use an abstract concept, is theory and practice, really, and what people say and what people do and so on. And you're suggesting that and you record a lot of conversations. One of the ways you capture an experience is through the dialogue. Let's talk a little about that, because I think in your book on intervention, you're really seeing a conflict between our abstract theories about what's going on in a place like Afghanistan and Iraq versus, you know, what's really going on and so on. And we become captives of our abstract ideas.
That's right. My sense is that we are obsessed with sorts of scientific descriptions of other people's societies. We think in terms of economics and numbers. We think in terms of grand doctrines. We have a counterinsurgency doctrine. Or we have Rand Corporation's Beginner's Guide to Nation Building. And all these so-called scientific models produce these theories on how it's supposed to work. Not in this particular place, but everywhere. They're universal, they're global, they're generic. And they have many flaws, two of which are Firstly, that they find it very, very, very difficult to take into account human history, psychology, imaginations, desires, resistance. They can't really deal with that. Right? So we can see this in drugs policy in the United States or Europe. And it's a classic example of something where you spend billions of dollars doing something that you can't do, partly because you don't really understand human nature. The second thing they find it very difficult to do is to see any value in something historical, any value in something that's there before they arrive. They tend to look at the past as slightly chaotic and untidy, and they want to do something neat and new and clean. So they often end up tearing up quite good functioning things and replacing them with things that don't work at all, because they are completely allergic to history, to culture, to people. They don't like that stuff. They like clean, tidy.
And also they haven't walked the walk, so to speak, in the way you did in Afghanistan. So they don't understand the richness, the depth, the complexity of the way things are being done over time.
That's one problem. And the second problem is that what people are trying to do is beyond the brains of the most brilliant person in the world. People are being asked somehow to go into a country like Iraq or Afghanistan and invent a political state. So we all turn up, whether we're Swedish or British or American, and we turn up and we say, you must have a democracy. Yeah. But none of us really know what a democracy means in our own country. We don't really know. Really understand how that works. How does that work with, for example, in very poor people in Arizona? How does it work with immigrant communities? How does corruption operate in our own countries? What really is the advantage or disadvantage of an American system against a British system, against a French system? All that's forgotten. It's too complicated for us. So we just turn up and we say, you're going to have a democracy. And we might say, slightly patronizing way, you know, it took us 100 years to get a democracy, so it'll take you a long time. Sounds fine, but we still don't really know what we're talking about. We don't really have a sense of what we're really offering anybody, how to really explain this to people, what they're going to get out of it. We have instincts. You know, we sort of imply if you have a democracy, you'll be richer, or if you have a democracy, you'll be safer. But actually, you really are also aware that somehow you've toppled a dictator like Saddam Hussein and nobody is safer and nobody is richer. It's all chaos and they've got a vote but they don't seem to have anything else, and how do you explain that to people and where's that going to go? And so I think they haven't walked the walk. In other words, they're not good enough at the granular stuff. But secondly, even the theories which they're trying to apply are really, really flimsy. You know, there are all these words like the rule of law or governance, but how many of the people talking about these things actually know what they mean when they talk about these things?
And in a way, these abstract ideas are then built on an edifice. So with things like poor historical analogies, illogic, a lack of really self-understanding, and then mixed with all kinds of human emotions. So we're going to go to Afghanistan because we fear, you know, the terrorist threat that will come from there.
Right, that's absolutely right. So there's deep, deep psychological things at work which make it very, very difficult to actually analyze clearly. That, of course, would be true if you were running a business, but it's much more true when you invade somebody else's country. Fear, right? These people pose an existential threat to global security, whatever that means. I mean, we don't even know what that means. I mean, does Texas pose an existential threat? I mean, what does this mean exactly, right? Secondly, guilt. Oh, we've invaded this country, we've caused a chaos, you know, we've broken it, we have to fix it. Or our soldiers have died, and we can't have soldiers dying in vain. And so fear and guilt, and then pride. You know, we are NATO, we are the West, you know, we can't be seen to be defeated, our credibility is at stake here. And out of that stuff, all of which has sort of trapped you there. Your fear, your guilt, your pride has trapped you in this destructive relationship. Then the justifications come behind it. And it's not very surprising that the theories turn out to be a little bit flimsy, because they're trying to justify something which is fundamentally irrational from the beginning.
And you make the suggestion, you're quoting McNamara in the intervention book, namely that some of this is about the clash of modernity, or what we perceive as being modern and so on, and our ways of doing things, and their immediate application and implementation in places that often remain very traditional. And traditional here is not meant as a pejorative. It's the way things have been done over time based on where these people are located, their geography, and so on.
And it's a particularly aggressive form of modernization. I mean, McNamara, you know, comes from the Ford Motor Company and was famous for his use of metrics and measurement and standardization. So it's the application of a very high modernist worldview, kind of thing we'd associate with central planning, measurement, everybody the same, on societies that by their very nature are almost at the opposite end of the spectrum. These are societies that have often not really gone through that process at all. So there's a, and it's something that happens across the developing world, whether you're intervening or not, this terrible sort of collision of people with a very strong idea of how things ought to be done with the way things are.
At one point in your book, you talk about fear, and you really show how the fear of terrorism and the reason why we have to be afraid is very much like the fear that got us into Vietnam,
right.
Namely fear of a country.
What's interesting is that when I looked at these fears, I found that there were four types of fear which seem to reoccur in almost every single time we get into a war. So the first is the fear that makes out that country as being the most dangerous thing conceivable. So Ronald Reagan famously in 1963 said that Vietnam posed the greatest threat that had ever faced humankind in his march from the swamp to the stars, right? The second kind of fear that you have is, okay, it's not this country. This country is actually an empty space. The problem with this country is the foreigners who come into it. It's a sort of failed space into which they come. And there you can find, you know, Russian foreign ministers in the 1860s talking about, you know, these empty barbarian spaces that cause problems to the world. Third kind of fear that we do is we say, okay, it's not the country, it's not the people coming into the country, it's the effect on the neighbors. So this, of course, in Vietnam is the domino theory, but in Afghanistan would be if Afghanistan falls, Pakistan will fall, mad mullahs will get their hands on nuclear weapons. And then the final one is, okay, maybe it's not about any of those things, it's about us. It's about our credibility. We can't be seen to be defeated. So I was very struck by the fact that once you've got those four, it doesn't matter where you go, Mali, Syria, North Korea, you can immediately apply these things. You know, why should we be in Syria? Oh, you know, Syria poses an existential threat to global security. Or two, no, the problem in Syria is the terrorists from elsewhere who are coming into Syria, or three, no, it's the region if Syria falls, everyone else will be destabilized, and four, our credibility. If we don't do something, we're going to be humiliated.
In looking at your book on intervention and looking at the way actors are driven, that is the people from outside who come in, you really show us that in some ways the international civil servants who come into countries, the generals who come into country with their soldiers, that they all are driven by bureaucratic structures in a way that obscure their thinking and their inability to see the reality on the ground. Everything from the fact that, if there's not security, they have to be taken everywhere with guards. They have to worry about their own careers and whether they're fulfilling the missions, whether those missions have anything to do with the reality. This must come from your experience in these various bureaucracies.
Yeah, well, as you say, I spend a lot of time in different kinds of bureaucracies, in the army, been in the foreign service, been in the U.S.-led occupation of Iraq, I've been at Harvard, I've run a nonprofit, and I'm now in Parliament. So these are all different forms of bureaucracy. And I suppose if I was going to produce a formal structural analysis, if you're really looking at what's happening here, you've got these irrational emotions like fear. You've got these high and sometimes flimsy and very abstract theories on the other hand. And then mediating between them, driven by them in different ways, is simply the incentive structure of being a soldier or being a diplomat, by which I mean, number one, you're there to do a job. You're not there to question whether the job is worthwhile. You're there to do the job. You're there to win. Secondly, you don't get promoted by being negative. You get promoted by being positive. Thirdly, the entire bureaucracy gathers behind you. It's a wonderful way of mobilizing agreement. It's a wonderful way of creating groupthink, of ignoring uncomfortable truths. So it's fascinating because what essentially you see is human societies can arrange themselves around projects which in retrospect are crazy, but arrange themselves around them very, very easily, very slickly. And perhaps for me the strongest example of that is the Crusades. I mean, you know, we like to think about Vietnam because it's close, but it's not a new phenomenon, this. If you were to sit down with somebody from the 12th century and say, what on earth do you think you're doing? I mean, you're a Scottish knight in shining armor. You're heading off to Palestine. You're doing what exactly? They would say, oh, no, this situation, you don't quite understand. You know, we've got very good information on what's happening in Damascus at the moment. Just got a good letter in from Genghis Khan. We think he's coming in from this side. And really, the indigenous population in Jerusalem is very much on our side. And we think there are dissensions within the court of the Mamluks. And the whole thing is splitting apart. And, you know, they would have been able, in the most extraordinary way, to explain to you why something which we know is mad was actually sensible.
You talk about the generals in Afghanistan, and I don't know how many commanders are U.S. of the NATO and U.S. forces there. There have been in a decade, say 7 to 10 or something like that. And each one comes in and sees the world the same. The mission previous has failed, and now there's going to be new resources, new leadership, and so on. And then when that general's term is over, the next guy comes in. And they're essentially fixing variables. So if the previous general centralized forces, then the next one decentralized. I mean, it's a pretty telling indictment of the extent to which the futility of the effort, given the structure, is not perceived by the actors.
That's absolutely right. The actors don't perceive the futility. And that's a really, I mean, you've given a very good summary of it. I suppose moving on, though, what do we do about this? I think what we do about this is to recognize that these are almost inevitable features of huge human bureaucracies lurching themselves into uncomfortable situations. And you can't really expect to fix these things. It seems to me sort of almost so hardwired in terms of the way in which our brains work, the way in which our emotions work, the way in which our theories work, that in catastrophic situations, anybody in charge, whether they're a general or a civilian, will say, oh, I've inherited a dismal situation, but I have a new plan requiring new resources which will deliver a decisive year, and simply set about reversing everything their predecessor has done in the hope that this will sort it out. The lesson, therefore, is to be unbelievably cautious about getting into these things in the first place. Because once you're there, it's not that people are ill-intentioned or stupid. These are highly able, highly intelligent, highly diligent individuals. But they are trapped. They cannot see outside their system. They really resent this kind of analysis. I mean, nobody wants to feel that they're somehow blind prisoners of a structure. So they hate anybody saying this to them. Nevertheless, I think it's true. I think in 20, 30 years' time, people will look back and think, what on earth do they think they were doing?
And you, at your stint at Harvard, you actually tried to gather a group of fellows who actually knew Afghanistan because they knew the language, they had lived there, they had worked in a sector like agriculture and so on, and you were trying to create a body of information and on the one hand convey it to students through teaching, but also interacting with prominent officials like Petraeus and Holbrooke. And what you're telling us is the Titanic wouldn't turn from the iceberg.
The Titanic definitely doesn't turn. General Petraeus, Ambassador Holbrooke were very generous with their time, But I never convinced them. And it's not really about me. I mean, these guys that I had at Harvard knew far more about Afghanistan than I did. I had 20, 30 years of experience, each of them, of the place. Couldn't convince them not to search. We all thought the search was crazy, right? We should not be putting more troops into Afghanistan. But it didn't matter how much those individuals in Harvard knew about Afghanistan. They just couldn't stop the system. More worrying, though, for me was perhaps the students. These very brilliant students that I had at Harvard basically thought in the end, I think, that I was exaggerating, that I was overly cynical, that I was a sort of colorful character who was being contrarian, but couldn't really take on board or accept that things were quite as bad as I said. So at the end of my class, many people would continue to say, oh, well, you know, all we need is a new plan with new resources and that'll sort it out. And many of them actually went out to work for these institutions in Afghanistan that I'd been trying to expose.
So the lesson here, if I can be so bold as to, is don't get into places in the first place. But what I'm curious about is what you see the role of political education. You're in politics now. I mean, is part of your job, and if it is, how do you do it, to educate people or policymakers to actually add some increment of knowledge to, once they're in these structures and in these places, to navigate better? Is that?
Yes, I think that's, for me, one of the most important potential roles of a politician. Because politicians, by their nature, are semi-detached from bureaucracies and are compelled, in order to get elected, but also out of personality, to spend a lot of time with people who are not professional government people in our districts or wherever. The most useful thing a politician can do is to try to be sufficiently objective or detached from bureaucracy for President Obama, for example, to say to the military, I think you're wrong. I don't think the search is going to work. I don't think this counterinsurgency strategy is going to get you where you want to be. But it's difficult. It's difficult. You're talking to a general with a row of medals on his chest who's been 5 years on the ground in Afghanistan, and you're a new president. I mean, and you don't really know much about the country. Have you really got the confidence, the instincts, the arguments to overcome this stuff? Because we're trained to think that we're rational. We're trained to think that we can argue our way out of these things. But it's very, very difficult because actually after 5, 6 years of one of these interventions, the side that's wrong has a lot of very attractive, convincing arguments. There's a lot of things they can say where unless you fight with them day in, day out, sound on the surface pretty good.
You've been an observer of humanity in all kinds of settings. What conclusion have you come to, basically, about?
Well, I suppose, intuitively, generally. I mean, this is a ridiculous generalization, but generally, I'm pretty optimistic about people. I generally feel that you can explain almost anything to people. People get things. I mean, they understand in their everyday lives, and most people I deal with are extraordinary, I mean, in their energies and their compassion and their capacities to do things. And so I'm optimistic about people, but I'm pretty doubtful about government bureaucracies and structures and ideas. So my general conclusion is that the only role I really have is to act as a sort of lens between people and government, back and forth, trying to explain the two sides to each other. In my country, 87% of people feel politics is broken. 88% think society is broken. I'm conscious, having not always been a politician, that people think politicians are the worst people on earth. I mean, they really think we are corrupt, incompetent thieves, right? And liars. But our salvation, or a very important part of our salvation, has to rely on somehow sorting this out, getting these two sides to understand each other, getting these two sides to challenge each other, getting these two sides to become better through that conversation.
So in a way, it's observing and confronting reality, but stripping yourself of the abstract theories and the human passions that prevent you from actually doing that act, and try to draw some conclusion that brings a...
It can work in a lot of different ways. It could be, for example, that my constituents want to have super fast broadband, live in remote rural communities where the government can't afford to provide it, and are prepared to dig the trench and lay the fiber optic cable themselves. And the government will say, we can't do that. We can't do that for legal reasons. We can't do that for procurement reasons. We can't do that for technological reasons. And you know it's nonsense. You know there's no reason, actually. It doesn't make any sense. Why couldn't the government do this? These people are prepared to do all this work. So a lot of the work of the politician is simply just saying again and again, why? I mean, it's actually almost quite a naive role being a politician.
One final question. Tell us a little about your non-governmental organization in Afghanistan, because you're obviously building on all of this experience.
Well, that's probably the project which I've been most proud of in my entire life, the one thing that I really, really have loved. And it is a project where we've gone into the northern district of the old city of Kabul, which was a slum. It was 7 feet deep in rubbish in parts. The buildings were derelict and collapsing. 1 in 5 children were dying before the age of 5. Adult life expectancy was 37. And there were beautiful crafts, traditional woodworkers and calligraphers, but they had no students to whom they could pass on their skills. So we went in. I started with one employee, so two of us, and we've built it up to about 600 people working with us now. We cleaned out all the garbage. We've installed water supply, electricity, sewerage. We've repaired over 90 buildings. We've created an institute for training craftspeople. We're beginning to do international exhibitions, sell these beautiful pieces of woodwork or ceramics or calligraphy around the world, or jewelry, and get the money back into the old city to sustain a clinic, a primary school. And I love it. I love it because it's a concrete, real community. I walk down that bazaar street and I've known these people for years. And if they don't like what's happening, they pop out of their shops and they shout at me. And that's what I like.
And what is it called, the project?
Turquoise Mountain.
And then one final question. How would you advise students to prepare for the future?
Well, my instinct with that is for them to go abroad and to live in somewhere very different, a small rural community, as a volunteer or like go in the Peace Corps, because nothing is more exciting or important than having in the back of your mind for the rest of your life somewhere very different from where you are as a way of challenging the received wisdom.
Well, on that note, Rory, thank you very much for taking the time to share with us your remarkable odyssey. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.